This is the Chris DeGaulle Show podcast.
Okay, guys, let's just rip. And Chris DeGaulle.
Chris DeGaulle. Chris, thanks for being with me tonight.
Chris DeGaulle.
I'm joined now by Chris DeGaulle.
Now, as downloadable as he is lovable, it's Chris DeGaulle.
It's Thursday, May 20th, and I thank you so much for downloading the Chris DeGaulle Show podcast. Coming up today, this is a special edition of the show because I wanted to do a deep dive into the subject of Israel and the Palestinians and this fight and the awful bloodshed that we're seeing right now in that region is something that I've often battled to understand, to be perfectly honest with you. I don't have a firm grasp on the subject matter. You may. And so this show may not be for you today, but I suspect that there are a great number of people who are in this audience who, like me, could benefit from a substantive discussion about the history of this conflict and where we are today and the players involved and who's on which side and why. For a better understanding, I would also encourage you, if you have the ability during this podcast, open up a map of the Middle East. Just, you know, Google image search a map of the Middle East with countries and borders and their names and take a good look at it as you hear me discuss today with the senior director of the Jewish Policy Center, a woman named Shoshana Bryan. We talk about Israel, but we talk about the surrounding countries. We talk about the evolution of this and this conflict and why it's happening. And by the end of the conversation, I hope that you come away from it. I know I did. It's an hour long today, and we're devoting the show to this, just trying to get a better sense of who are the players and what's the fight about, and is there a resolve, and how can we get there? I would love your thoughts on this, but I didn't make it too deep, I don't think. I don't think the conversation is too over anybody's head, but it is the thinker of a podcast for sure, and again, geographically speaking, it helps if you're looking at a map of the Middle East while we talk about it so that you can have a better appreciation of the geography. That helped me a lot anyway. So anyway, I hope this is a useful podcast to you today as you try to discern just exactly what's going on with Shoshana Bryan and myself in this conversation today from the Jewish Policy Center. And it's in part brought to you by my friend and dentist, Bob Spinato at Williamsburg Dental, who's in Broomall, Pennsylvania, right off the Blue Route, as it's known in Philadelphia. If you are looking for cosmetic dentistry, if you're looking for a whiter, brighter smile, nobody better than my friend Bob. And if you're just looking for a general dentist, if you're in the Philadelphia region, and I'm talking about region, even if you're not in the immediate southeast of Pennsylvania, look, I know people certainly that come from South Jersey. I know people that have come from New York. I know people that fly from Florida for cosmetic work done with Bob. So it's not out of line. I mean, you only see a dentist every 6 months. And when you have a cosmetic overhaul of your smile, as Bob did for me years ago, this is worth going out of your way for when you're dealing with excellence like Bob. Bob is tops in cosmetic dentistry, and he's rated as such by people who vote every single year. His fellow dentists in the field, they vote him time and again, top cosmetic dentist in our region. Mainline Today magazine, Philadelphia magazine, they all have said it for almost a decade. And I just happen to find him to be a decent, fine man. He's compassionate. He's delicate. He doesn't want to scare you. He doesn't want to hurt you. He doesn't want to judge you. And I get the nicest emails from people when they finally do go and they say, "You're right. Everything you said about him is right. He took great care of me. He didn't hurt me. Thank you for the recommendation, Chris." Check him out. Williamsburg-dental.com for some of the before and after pictures. Williamsburg-dental.com or call 610-353-2700. And when you do, tell him Chris sent you. He will whiten your smile for $200. That's his cost. All right. Normally it's much more. But for you, the podcast listener, he will whiten your smile at his cost, which is just $200 out of your pocket, and you get a professional whitening. But you got to call and make the appointment, 610-353-2700 or Williamsburg-dental.com. He's Bob Spinato at Williamsburg Dental. One of the things that I really wanted to commit the show to doing throughout this latest installment of this awful conflict that we're seeing on the news that Israel currently finds itself embroiled in yet again, I really wanted to try to understand it, fundamentally understand it from the jump. And I just don't. I readily confess I come to this conversation with a very, very puddle-deep knowledge of history and kind of what's behind this conflict. And so I think when so many Americans see on the news a conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, What does it mean? Where does the conflict come from? What is the history behind it? And we hear over and over through, as long as I've been paying attention to politics, United States presidents trying to get in the middle of brokering peace. And it seems there may be peace or there may be a discussion of peace, and then there's not for long. And so what is it all about, really? Where does it stem from? And so I bring in an expert on the subject today, and we're going to do a deeper dive into this discussion. Her name is Shoshana Bryan, and she is the senior director of the Jewish Policy Center in Washington. And Shoshana, I'm so glad that you were able to join me today. Hi.
It's a pleasure to be here, Chris.
And I don't know how many.
That's a big question.
Yeah.
Start with a big question.
I don't know how much Americans know on balance. Would you say that we Americans are well-versed or not very versed in this background, this history, this conflict?
Not very well-versed, by and large.
So, to begin with, yeah, let's start.
The conflict has more players than you've indicated. There's a difference between the Palestinians, Arab states, Iran as a major player here, and the United States and Israel.
So as I look at a map, it is bigger. And certainly as I look at a map of the Middle East, and if you ever do this, and I would encourage everyone to do it just for the sake of, you know, getting acclimated to the lay of the land, you see Israel surrounded by people, the names of the nations that surround Israel, and you realize the way I likened it is, what if everyone on your street wanted to burn your house down and kill you, didn't think you belonged in the neighborhood? That's the way I look at a map and see Israel, surrounded by neighbors who really would rather they not be there. That's the way I interpret it. Fair?
Almost fair. If you look at the neighbors on your map around Israel, you have Lebanon to the north, you have Syria to the north, Iraq to the north, Jordan and Egypt. Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq are all occupied by Iran. You have Hezbollah, which is a terror proxy of Iran in Lebanon, which spoils any possibility of Lebanese people and Israeli people having anything to do with each other. Iran still occupies most of Syria. Iran and Iraq are having their own form of war, and none of it is good for Israel. So you have Iran as a fundamental player here on the north side. Jordan and Egypt have peace treaties with Israel, and if you look at your map, down the Red Sea, Israel now has relations, very good relations, with Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, with Oman, with Saudi Arabia, quietly but still good. So there are lots of different players and lots of different things. But where Iran comes into the picture, you end up with problems. And this relates to the Palestinians specifically as well. But in your regional picture, to the north is Iran. Iran hates Israel.
Yeah,
and Iran hates the West.
Of those nations you mentioned, and I know you, in fact, President Trump famously ended up, I guess, injecting himself into brokering some peace accords with United Arab Emirates, for instance, and Bahrain. Were those meaningful? When we hear about these peace accords, what does that really mean? And what's the history of peace accords? Are they just pieces of paper, or do Israelis feel like those are real and meaningful and tangible? And are people honest brokers sticking to the terms of those things long term?
Again, different countries, different policies. By and large, yes, they are very, very important. They are very valid. Even Jordan, which is a very shaky country by itself, lives to the terms of the peace accord. Egypt is even better. Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates have established a real working relationship with Israel that is economic, it's social. Here's a little piece of esoterica. There's a thing called a Bet Din. It's a Jewish court. It adjudicates kind of Jewish issues for Jewish people, okay? It's not in place of civil courts. After the expulsion of most Jews from most of the Middle East after 1948, there is a Bet Din in Bahrain. It's called the Bet Din of Arabia. So putting a Jewish court in the United Emirates, United Arab Emirates, is a signal that Jews are welcome. Israelis are welcome. It's a huge, huge turning point.
Let me hit rewind and go all the way back to what you just mentioned, the 40s. Because let's just give a basic history lesson for all of us, because I think to start this conversation, we have to understand where Israel began and why. So can you help sort of set that table again?
Okay, so Israel began 3,000 years ago, but let's go to the current modern times. after World War One, Britain and France were the mandatory powers of the region, and they created states, independent states. They created Iraq, they created Syria, they created Lebanon. That's what they did. They created Jordan. Palestine had been a division of the Ottoman Empire. It wasn't a country. It was never independent. There was never an Arab ruler there. It was always ruled 400 years by the Turks. Turks lost World War I, so Britain decided to divide up the District of Palestine. Jews wanted it, wanted a piece of it. The British have tried many times to divide that territory between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea between Arabs and Jews. They started with the Peel Commission in, 1937. And from 1937 to 48, they put forward in the UN a number of division plans for the territory that had been Palestine, that had been Ottoman Palestine. The Jordanians got everything east of the Jordan River, and which should have been the Palestinian state. But anyway, they put a Hashemite king from Arabia there, and it became Jordan, and tried to subdivide from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. It didn't work. And it didn't work because the Arabs were never willing to have a discussion about where the boundary should be that would allow Jews to have an independent country. Never agreed.
They
didn't show up to meetings. They didn't agree. They said they would kill it. They said they would strangle it. Didn't want it.
This region of the world, obviously, rooted in scriptural history, biblical history, this is... I think this is where it may get complex for certain folks, because there is a biblical meaning to this land. It's holy. And so there's the geopolitical discussion about it, and then there's the biblical discussion about it. And I think for a lot of secular people, the biblical discussion about it doesn't matter at all, but you can't extract one from the other for Jews.
You can't, and that's why Jews said, look, it doesn't matter so much where you draw the boundary. The Jewish community in Palestine agreed to every single boundary that was put forward, including some really weird ones. For the Jewish community, the idea was to be able to return to those places that were holy a long time ago in the current context. And if the current context meant you divided it and your holy place was in the Arab state of Palestine, that was okay, as long as you could go there. So the Jews were looking for a return to the space, but the modern division of the space was less important than the ability to be in the space. I'm not sure that makes sense.
They weren't looking
at the biblical boundaries of Israel. Those were not relevant. What was relevant was a modern understanding of Jewish commitment to the land in some boundary.
So Jewish people wanted a place to be able to go out of reverence, out of history, out of tradition. And it didn't necessarily matter that it was under the purview of their governed land. Is that accurate?
Well, that's partly accurate. Jews always lived in that space. There was never a time from the Bible to the present when there weren't Jews there. So certain places were occupied by Jews, not occupied, lived in by Jews from the beginning, including Jerusalem, including Sfat, including whatever. So the Jews said, look, it is our indigenous space.
When
all
did
the
that
time
change?
That we were exiled.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you. When did that change? So Jews have always occupied that space, and throughout history, what? There have been other people moving in, claiming it as theirs. How did that evolve?
Yes, that's exactly how it evolved.
Okay.
Jews have lived there. The Romans expelled the Jews. See, we're going back to this history I don't want to do, but we can do it for a minute.
It's important, sure.
The Romans expelled the Jews in the early part of the last millennium. But they didn't expel them all. There were some left. And the Jews remained in Jerusalem and Sfat and Haifa and certain other places always. But they couldn't govern themselves. First of all, they were under Roman occupation. And then there were various occupations of the entire thing forever, up until the modern time. The last occupier, the last long-term occupier, were the Ottomans from 15-something until they lost World War One in 1919. So there never was a Jewish state. There never was an Arab state. There never was a Palestinian state. Egypt, yes, was a country. But Syria was a province. Lebanon, the French colonized. You know, everybody colonized everybody occupied. Jews were, I wouldn't say they were okay with it, okay? But they lived under it because they could go to their holy places.
There was no established border or countries for a long time.
They were all provinces of the Ottoman Empire.
Gotcha.
For example, there was a Baghdad province. Now, here's something for people to understand. When Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, he said he was only taking back the 18th province of Baghdad that had historically belonged to Baghdad. And you know what? He was right. Historically, Kuwait's territory belonged to the Ottoman province of Baghdad. Now, modern life gave us the Sheikhdom of Kuwait, and you can't invade it, and we didn't let him invade it. But historically speaking, yes. So the Jews were in a similar position. They lived in their historic spaces, but they were never governing.
And these borders, these countries or states, however you wish to describe them, they've traditionally always been set up or drawn by others. It's not like there's been a committee where everybody sits down in the region and says, all right, well, here's where our border is going to be and here's where our border ends. And it seems like there's always been sort of another entity, like the Brits, for instance, who step in and say, here's how we think we'll parse it out. Is that sort of the way this worked?
Absolutely. And Turkey and northern Iraq, that's why they fight between Turkey and northern Iraq, because the British split the Kurds between Iraq and Turkey when they drew the boundary. Syria claims the northern part of Jordan. So all of these, Syria didn't recognize a country of Lebanon until the Taif Accords in 1990, whatever it was. They didn't recognize that Lebanon was a separate country because all these things were done by people from the outside, including the boundaries of Israel.
Let me ask something that's kind of provocative and maybe very ignorant, but I'll just say it. We're dealing with almost exclusively Muslim-majority nations surrounding Israel. Is that true?
Yes. Yes, it is.
So let's just get right to the heart of it to begin with. On balance, how would you describe globally, generally, generically speaking, broadly, when you think of Muslims and you think of Jews, I don't, in my head, have a very harmonious relationship, but I don't really understand it. I know there's great hate and anti-Semitism to the point of places like Iran want to wipe Israel off the map, but I don't know that that's the entirety of all Muslims. So can you help me understand that? Is it total hostility surrounding Israel?
No. No. And it's a very good question and a very important question. There is a belief in Islam, and there are many strains of Islam. You have to remember, it is not a unified picture. Okay, any more than Christianity is a unified picture. There is a strain inside of Islam that says Islam has to rule every place it ever ruled. So when you had the Muslim conquest, which went into Spain, Muslims believe, there is a strain of Muslims who believe that they need to retake Andalusia because they once had it. Those people don't like Christians, don't like Jews, don't like anybody. And that is, by the way, a fairly prominent strain of Islam. People who think that Jews are okay if they live under Muslim rule, Christians are okay if they live under Muslim rule, Muslims have to rule. There are many other Muslims and strains of Islam that don't see it that way. And the Quran itself recognizes Jewish patrimony, first of all, in Jerusalem, which is really important, and secondly, in the space of Israel, in the Eastern Mediterranean space. So there are many Muslims who feel that Jews are cousins and brothers and belong in the space.
Is that most?
That's how you get Bet Din in Arabia.
Is that most, half, a third? I mean, if you could quantify it in the global population.
I can't quantify it. I would say, and here's the problem if you're on and propaganda and all this, I would say the majority are not in favor of Jews having a state.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they all want to kill them. I really don't. The vast majority of Muslims would not kill a Jewish person or a Christian person under any circumstances. Do they think that they should have equal rights in a country and governance of a country that was once Muslim? No, I don't think they do believe that. So Israel is a problem for them,
okay,
whereas Jews may not be.
The existence of a state of Israel is a portion of land they don't control, and they resent that, many of these people, if not most.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a very good short answer.
Okay. I'm starting to, yes. Okay. Now this is starting to at least make sense. So then you enter into people that are quite willing to kill, you know, and say out loud, it's not just enough to say we don't really think you're entitled to this land. We don't really want you to exist. I mean, and we know historically, obviously, in more modern history, the just god-awful Holocaust, it sounds like it's sort of a modern-day Holocaust of sorts in some of their language, that they, again, they want to continue that notion of Jews should not exist as people, not have a land, but shouldn't exist as people, period. Is that a prominent strain? Is that an accurate summation?
It's an accurate summation of a small slice of Islam. The bigger slice is the second thing you said, which is we don't think you should have a state.
Okay.
Okay, the group of people who think you have to kill all the Muslims, kill all the Jews, and kill all the Christians, that's a real small segment. Remember, Islam is a huge religion around the world. Those people who would kill the Jews are a small group. They happen to reside primarily in the Middle East, where there are Jews.
Well, and they fly buildings into planes on 9/11, and they blow up, you know, pressure cookers,
yes,
at Iran's, and they shoot up nightclubs in Paris and things like that. So it's not exclusive to you and Israel.
No, it is not exclusive to Israel. It is directed at people who don't submit to their authority.
Yes.
And that would be Americans, and that would be Israelis, and that would be, you know, they're trying to change the nature of French society right now in ways that are really very difficult for the French, who think they have a secular country where it's not supposed to matter where you pray.
I know
you
this.
Don't pray there.
This sounds like a really ridiculous question, but I'll ask it anyway. Israel is not exclusively Jewish. And this kind of notion that everyone in Israel is Jewish is not true.
Correct. 20% of Israel's population is not Jewish. They're primarily Arab. They're primarily Arab Muslims, but there's also a very substantial community of Arab Christians. And Arab Christians are like a missing piece of the entire conversation in the Middle East. It used to be a substantial community in Lebanon. Most of it has fled. It's persecuted by Muslims who are also Arabs because they are Christian. So in Israel, you have 20% of the population is not Jewish.
So an Israeli Arab, that 20% or the Christian Arab, what is their relationship with Jews?
They are citizens of the same state, and until last week, they were doing pretty well at it. Every citizen of the state of Israel, regardless of origin, religion, color, whatever, is exactly like every other citizen. They vote, they pay taxes, they do what they do, you know, they're citizens, okay? And the integration of Israel's non-Jewish population was a point of pride both for Arabs and for Jews in the country. The one thing that Arab citizens are exempt from is service in the Israeli Defense Forces. The reason for that being they didn't want to ask Arabs if there was a war to go kill other Arabs. However, you can volunteer if you're an Israeli Arab into the armed forces. And they do. There are many, many Arab Christian and Arab Muslim soldiers in the IDF.
Here's what I think. Here's what I would guess then. That I'll liken it crudely to here in the United States, left-wing Black Lives Matter types hate people like Tim Scott, who are Republican senators, and they will call them awful names like Uncle Tom and traitors to their race and that sort of thing. Is that the kind of dynamic between, say, the Hamas element attacking Israel right now and those Arabs who would pledge their loyalty to Israel?
Yes. They're very close.
They're traitors.
And one of the things that Hamas has done, and by the way, the Palestinian Authority has done, is intimidate the Israeli Arab community and say, if you don't fight the Jews, if you don't have an uprising, if you don't have a riot, you're not a loyal person. And, you know, if you're not a loyal person in their context, they'll kill you. I mean, I don't fear for the life of Tim Scott. I'm happy to say, as an American, I suspect that Senator Scott is going to be with us for a long time. But in their context, they kill what they consider to be traitors. in Israel, but also and primarily, and here's where you're going to get to the Israel-Palestinian conflict now, they intimidate the people on the West Bank and in Gaza to not deal with Israelis and not deal with Jews. If you do, you are suspect.
Palestine, the Palestinians, this term Hamas, they're interchangeably linked and used, and they're confusing to me because I don't always know. One speaks of geography, one speaks of an actual group. So I need to understand the difference. What is the Palestinian state versus and Palestinian Authority, Hamas, these terms that we hear, is it all hostility neighboring Israel when you talk about Palestine?
That is such a good question. The first Palestinian identity, as an identity as opposed to people under Ottoman rule, was in 1964, before there were what there are called occupied territories, before the 67 war. The PLO was founded in 1964 because they felt that Jordan should be a Palestinian state. I mentioned earlier, the king of Jordan is a family from Arabia. They're not local people, okay? They were imported by the British. And the king is not a Palestinian. So they wanted to overthrow the king. It was a nationalist movement to provide physical space for the Palestinians to live in as Palestinians. They wanted Jordan. After 67, when Jordan attacked Israel in the Six-Day War and acquired the West Bank and the Gaza Strip from Egypt, Palestinian thinking was still aimed at Jordan. There was a Palestinian uprising against the King of Jordan in 1970. Okay, even after Israel had territories, they were still aiming at Jordan. So the evolution of Palestinian national identity comes from their unhappiness with the Kingdom of Jordan, more than Israel, actually.
Hmm.
But now you have Israel in control of the West Bank territory and the Gaza territory, and they unfolded in different ways. The Palestinian Authority is a nationalist, not secular, it's definitely Muslim, but much more nationalist, secular group. Hamas in Gaza is an arm of the Muslim Brotherhood. It is a nationalist religious group, and they fight each other. And they had a civil war in Gaza in 2007, where Hamas threw Fatah out of the Gaza Strip and took complete control of the Gaza Strip in 2007. A lot of what they do, Israel's in the way of, but it isn't the cause of, they fight each other for control of Palestinian lives and their view of the future.
So there's a very big internecine war inside the Palestinian people, within the Palestinian
Huge.
People.
Mm-hmm. Huge. Between the secularists or the nationalists and the religious.
So there are
and
secular...
And Iran stokes that.
Is it fair to say there are secular Palestinians that mean Israel no harm?
Yes, it is fair to say that. Particularly over the last, 15 years, when the Palestinian Authority was set up under the Oslo Accords, a lot of secular Palestinians thought, okay, we're going to have an opportunity to govern ourselves, and then we're going to have an independent country. The problem for them was, first of all, the Palestinian Authority is totally corrupt. Everybody knows that. And secondly, it became more and more totalitarian as time went on, and these, what were then, young secular Palestinians who were educated, many of them had been educated in Europe, and who wanted to run a country, didn't have an opportunity. So you have increasing repression now, even now, in the West Bank against young Palestinians or even old Palestinians who would like to, first of all, govern themselves, and secondly, want to make a living for their families. And this is where you get to the BDS movement, boycott, disinvest, and sanction. People who don't want Israelis to have industry on the West Bank that employs West Bank people. Which is the stupidest thing I can think of, BDS. Palestinians need to work. They need to feed their families. They work for Jews, and they don't care. I mean, it's not like they're supporting, the Israeli army. They work in factories. They work in places. They make a lot more money working for Israelis than they make working for Palestinians, and the Israelis are not corrupt. So, yeah, there's a whole group of people who would just like to be left alone to make their lives.
And now here's where this starts to get political to us in the United States. And you look at the Democrats in Congress and you talk about Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and AOC, these people who are now openly hostile to Israel and seeming to suggest that Israel is the aggressor. And I'm honestly, even though I know it's completely off its rocker and completely ridiculous, I'm trying, just for the sake of this discussion, to understand at all where they're coming from. Can you lend credibility for half a second to their argument, if not to just explain it to us, even though I think there's no merit to it. I'm trying to even comprehend what they're communicating.
It's an important argument to be able to dismantle because it's stupid on its face. And I will try.
Okay, good. Okay. I hope you can.
They would like a Palestinian state somewhere.
So there is not one right now? There is not one.
No, there is not one, because the Palestinians won't accept one. Here's a question for people who ask this question. What map has the Palestinian negotiating team ever put forward in a negotiating context that says, here's where Palestine is, and here's where Israel is? You give me these occupied territories, and I'll leave your state alone. There is no such map, because the Palestinians believe, at least in their fundamentalist point of view, that all of it is Palestine.
Okay,
they can't make themselves say, well, okay, fine, the Israelis can have Haifa. Okay, the Israelis can have Tel Aviv. Okay, the Israelis can have Beersheba. They can't say that. The PLO charter, which is the governing document for both Hamas and Fatah, says Palestine from the river to the sea. That means everything from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River has to be Palestine. And if you can't get past that bit of understanding that there must be a space for a legitimate state of Israel, you understand why there's no Palestinian state.
So, just, and I'm really sorry to make this so ridiculously crude and lame an example, but to try to put it in a context of the United States map for a second, just to maybe help at least my pea brain understand this, would this be akin to saying lots and lots of Mexican people live in Texas, and lots and lots of Mexican people would like Texas to be Mexico and all theirs and not a part of the United States? And of course, Texans say, well, no, we're a part of the United States, but okay, fine, let's sit down and decide what part of Texas you Mexican folks would like, and we'll let you call it Mexico, but they won't. They want all of Texas or none.
I think that was settled a long time ago, but yes, that probably at some point was a conversation.
But is that analogous? That's a clumsy. I know it's clumsy, but is that a way to think of it?
It's only clumsy because you have to stop saying those things. I mean, you're really asking very good questions.
Okay.
It's only clumsy because we as Americans settled our borders with wars or with treaties.
Mm-hmm.
We had a war with Mexico. And yes, there are still Mexicans who say, well, Texas and New Mexico, it's ours, right? But nobody believes it, and no one's going to war over it anymore. They're just not. The United States, over the years, is established. Now, the problem with taking that to the Middle East is, yes, there are Palestinians who believe that the whole thing is theirs, and the Jews don't have any part of it, and the Israelis, even Israeli Arabs, don't have any part of it, and it's not settled yet. It's in that stage. And here's where you have the problem of outside players. Iran is stoking this fire. Where do you think Hamas got all those rockets and missiles from?
Mm-hmm.
So they keep telling Hamas, we're gonna liberate Palestine. We're going to kill the Jews. And the Iranians, wait a minute, the mullahs, not the Iranians. The Iranian people do not like their government, and most of them would be fine with Israel. But the mullahs say, look, we're going to liberate Palestine because that's their internal operating mode, okay? And they fund for Hamas, and they fund for Hezbollah in Lebanon, thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of rockets and missiles, which Hamas and Hezbollah put in the middle of towns and cities in Lebanon and in the West Bank. So now you're coming up to today's problem. They put them in the middle of their own people. This is a war crime. This is by itself a violation of international law to put them there.
They're using citizens as human shields, basically.
Citizens as human shields. You got it. The Iranians stoke the fire. On both sides, they stoke the Palestinian Authority fire, but mostly they stoke the Hamas fire. And they want Palestine from the river to the sea. Under that circumstance, it's impossible to create peace. While you have people that are doing this with the weapons and the propaganda and what they teach their children, oh my God, I don't know if you have kids, but what they teach their children is revolting about how they have to grow up to die, how Allah wants them to come in a million little pieces because they blew up Jews. This is what they teach children. And as children grow up, they believe that stuff.
And so we get American media, and this is what's so disgusting, Shoshana, is we get American media like the Los Angeles Times just yesterday. My wife sent me a headline, and I saw something similar from another media outlet. They portray it like, look at what Israel's doing to these poor people. Look at the children who are in the rubble and how awful. It's like for Israel to defend itself, they must— you've just described that this chaos is happening in the midst of civilians by design, and for Israel to defend itself, it has no choice. And then they're made to look like the evildoer because innocent lives are taken in the process of defending itself.
Yes, that is your problem. And what those people say is it's disproportionate. That's a huge word today in the media, that Israel is being is responding out of proportion. Those people think that proportionality means you need a ratio of bullets expended or dead bodies. You know, I don't know what people want. Do they want more dead Israelis? Do they want, you know, 4,000? Hamas has launched 4,000 rockets now into Israel. Do they want Israel to send 4,000 rockets into Gaza? I don't think so. But that's not what proportionality means. It's not about ratios of ammunition or bodies. It's about the proportion of force used against a military target and whether the collateral civilian damage is commensurate with the value of the military target. Armies are allowed to take out military targets wherever they are. And if Hamas is so horrible as to put them in the middle of cities, that doesn't mean that Israel can't take them out. It means that Israel has to use as much care and as much caution as they can to limit the collateral damage and the civilian damage. Hamas, on the other hand, shoots right into cities. So it's a double war crime. Not only do they put the guns among their own, but they fire into Israeli cities.
There's this wonderful video of the late Joan Rivers, and I know you would probably be loath to invoke a comic in making this analogy, but she really did actually do an exceptional job years ago. She was at an airport. TMZ caught up with her and was asking back when a similar situation was happening a few years ago and Hamas was lobbing rockets into Israel. And she said, this is outrageous. She said, if New Jersey was lobbing rockets into New York, we wouldn't tolerate it. And when you think about it that way, if New Jersey's lobbing missiles into New York, what would the United States' response be? You know, would you have to kill some New Jersey citizens to end that? You probably would, but you couldn't allow that to continue, is the point.
First of all, I love Joan Rivers.
Yes.
Secondly, I come from New Jersey. But even with both of those things, I would say to you, yes, New York would have a right to respond. The chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court in 2006 was looking at potential U.S. war crimes that had happened in Iraq in 2003 with our invasion. We didn't commit any, as it turns out. But what he said about this applies today. Under international humanitarian law and the Rome Statute, the death of civilians during an armed conflict, no matter how grave and regrettable, does not itself constitute a war crime. Belligerents are permitted to carry out proportionate attacks against military objectives, even when it's known that some civilian deaths or injuries will occur. The crime occurs when there's an intentional attack against civilians. Okay, so Israel is taking out military objectives in Gaza. And yes, there are civilian casualties, but Israel having been attacked by rockets first is a legitimate belligerent and is entitled to defend itself. New Yorkers would have a claim to make if they bombed New Jersey. Oh, God, I can't believe I said that.
So Israel is willing, has been willing over the years to say, all right, all right, all right, we will give you a chunk of our established country if that's what you need. Just tell us where to start, what you want. Let's talk. Your suggestion is that there's never been an offer of we'd be happy with X and we'll walk away happy and that's that.
Never. And by the way, in the year 2000, the Israeli prime minister offered the Palestinians 100% of the West Bank, a little bit of land swap, you know, on the borders, but 100% of the territory, and offices in Jerusalem for the Palestinians, not a government, not to split the city. Israelis will never divide the city of Jerusalem again, but with offices for the Palestinians in Jerusalem. How much more could you want than all the land you lost in 67?
Yes.
And Arafat walked away from it, and Bill Clinton said, Arafat made me look bad. He did. He wouldn't take 100%. There's a ringer in here. The Palestinian refugee population, which people kind of don't think about, it's not the refugee population of 1948. It's their grandchildren and great-grandchildren today. There are hundreds of thousands of them living in what are essentially prisons run by the United Nations in an agency called UNRWA. They've been imprisoned there for generations. They are not permitted to be citizens of any other place, except, by the way, those who were refugees and ended up in the state of Israel became citizens of Israel. Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, Jordan, West Bank, Gaza, all have refugee camps in which they imprisoned these people for generations. And in Lebanon, by the way, you can't leave even to have a job. You have to live in the camp. So they promised their people, we will return you to Israel. We will erase the state of Israel. We will return you, refugees, to your safe. Having made that promise over generations now, they can't back out.
Yeah.
What are they going to say? Oh, my God, your great-great-grandparents were refugees from Israel. You're not going back. They can't say it.
Yes, and now the mean Israelis are keeping them from the land that's been promised them, is what they've been taught over the years. Yeah. Yeah.
So the State Department figures there are about 20,000 original refugees, right? That's 72 years ago. It's a long time ago. About 20,000 original refugees. The Clinton administration said, we can settle this with compensation. We can pay these people. They lost their homes in Israel. We'll pay them. The Palestinian Authority said no. They don't want compensation. They want to go home.
Mm-hmm.
Not possible.
So there is no such thing as a Palestinian. There is no Palestine. There is no. These are people. We're basically. I think I've always thought of this as incorrect. We're talking about the nation of Israel and people who live within Israel, warring with, attacking the country from within. In essence, is that
no? Be careful. Well, got to stop you there.
Okay.
The people who live in the state of Israel have been good citizens of the state of Israel. This week, they're having their version of race riots. They are rioting inside of Israel. Those are citizens. But the Palestinians of the West Bank and Gaza are not citizens of Israel.
West Bank and Gaza geographically are not considered Israel proper?
No, never have been.
Okay.
The West Bank was supposed to be an Arab state, except that Jordan took it over in the War of 48 and annexed it to Jordan, which was not recognized by the United States or any other country in the world except Britain and Pakistan. So Jordan annexed the West Bank. At one point, Palestinians who lived on the West Bank had Jordanian citizenship because the Jordanians said, nope, you're Jordanians now. No more Palestinian, you're Jordanian. They took away that citizenship from West Bankers in 1988. Which nobody seems to have noticed, but that's okay. Gaza, which is physically unconnected to the West Bank, was occupied by Egypt. It was used as a duty-free port for the Egyptian military and a place from which to attack Israel. So in the 67 war, when Jordan and Egypt attacked Israel, Israel fought back. They took over those territories, and those people in the West Bank and Gaza are adrift. So Israel said, fine, now we can make the Palestinian state that was supposed to happen in 48. But didn't happen, so now we'll make it happen now. And here you can't get Palestinians to agree.
So Israel would be willing, has tried to make West Bank and Gaza a true Palestinian state, call those territories Palestinian.
Yes, they have tried multiple times. I have a list of them next to me, but your listeners probably don't need the list. But yes, they've tried multiple times. Now, I have to tell you, I'm not sure today that they would agree. Today, meaning this morning, because Iran has so infiltrated the Gaza territory, I'm not sure I would allow it to be an independent state. It would be creating a hostile open sore on my border. No. West Bank also, it's very problematic. Now, it shouldn't have been problematic. Under Oslo in 1993, with President Clinton, with Rabin, with Arafat, it should have been possible. It's a long time ago now. Should have been possible.
When
Arafat wouldn't do it.
When you sit down with people like Yasser Arafat back in the 90s and Bill Clinton, I remember that, you know, the guy famously with the headscarf and the
right.
trip to Camp David and the hand holding and that sort of thing. He was never a serious person, was he? He was a fundamentalist. He always struck me, talking with him was like, it always felt like you were kind of, you know, sitting down negotiating with a 9/11 hijacker. They want to slam the plane into buildings and kill people. I don't think they ever honestly really wanted anything to come of that, did they?
No, they really didn't. They were happy terrorists.
Yeah.
They lived in southern Lebanon and ran a little terror enclave in southern Lebanon. They lived in Tunisia. And by the way, they killed American and French diplomats in Africa. And shouldn't be forgotten that Arafat was not a friend of the United States either.
He
killed two American diplomats.
That's what I mean. Is it naive to think that a United States president can get involved and actually broker anything between this element of the Palestinian people and Israel? Because you're talking about a group of people that are not negotiating in good faith. So, I mean, I know you've got to try to do something, but it just feels silly to even, I mean, you're negotiating with someone that doesn't want to negotiate. They don't think the other side they're quote negotiating with should exist.
Well, so here's what happened in the Trump administration. The United States made a huge, huge decision that peace in the Middle East would not be linked to a resolution of the issue of Palestine, but rather coordinating the interests of like-minded countries. So they stepped aside from the Palestinians, cut off their money, cut off the money to UNRWA, saying, look, you guys have been corrupt and antagonistic and everything else. They looked to the Gulf states, who share America's and Israel's view of Iran as a threat to their security in the region. And they said, look, you guys should be talking to each other. The United Arab Emirates is a very forward-looking kind of place. It is. Years ago, they decided you can't just export oil and pay off your people. You have to do something to make the UAE a profitable place on its own. Bahrain the same. And so they did. And then they looked at Israel and they said, you know what? The Israelis feel about Iran the way we do. The Israelis feel about commerce and trade and capitalism the way we do. Let's talk to them. And that's where the Abraham Accords come from, is this concept that if a country looks at its own national interests in the region, Israel can be a partner, not an enemy.
So
that's huge.
Yeah.
And I will credit the Trump administration for seeing the difference between beating the dead horse of Camp David and trying to find common interests among countries.
Okay. So in other words, let's get people who aren't hostile to Israel together to the table and get them to lay pressure on Iran, because you've established it's Iran that stokes all this. You cut the money and you cut the influence from Iran out of this, and this becomes a lot more calm. And so other
Absolutely.
Surrounding nations who will come to the table and say, all right, we'll all agree, no matter what we feel about Israel, we all have a common problem with Iran, so let's deal with them, is the thinking.
Well, it's partly that, but it's also that they also believed they had to do better by their own people. So, yes, it's against Iran in the security sense. But at least for the Gulf states, It's a positive impulse to work with Israel. They want to work with Israel on economics, on investment, on energy, and they have plans for this. And this is driving the Iranians crazy, and it's driving the Palestinians crazy. And it drives AOC crazy, and it drives Rashida Tlaib crazy, because they want the Palestinians to be the center of the conversation. And the Trump administration put them on the side and said, let's solve the problems we can solve and not solve the problem we can't solve.
Yeah, you'll because there's obviously, as long as the Palestinian people are controlled by this radical fringe group called Hamas, there will never be a good faith negotiation sit down with Israel. Never.
Hamas or the Palestinian Authority. Neither one of them is committed to a negotiated settlement.
Yeah, I mean, the Palestinian people need a legitimate, quote, legitimate government, one that's not a fundamentalist radical wacko that's committed to annihilating Israel and Jews in general, right? They just need, if the people, the civilized, calm, non-hateful, non-bigoted people, those Palestinians had a government that represented them truly, you could have a legitimate discussion.
That's why they were supposed to have elections. That was the theory behind elections, that people would choose who they wanted to govern them. But as I said, the last Palestinian legislative election was in 2007. The last Palestinian presidential election was in 2006. And in the intervening years, they have tried very hard and they have succeeded in wiping out dissent, shoving it underground, getting it into exile. So I'm not sure right this minute if you could have a legitimate election. I don't know. But yes, that is the principle. The principle is if people could choose the way they live, most of them in the territory would not choose this.
Do you think that people like Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and AOC, for instance, just to name a few, are they radicals in the sense of are they fundamentalists? Are they Islamists? Do you think they cleave to and identify with an idea that Jews ought not exist? And they should
You wouldn't go
that far. Okay.
I don't go that far. No, I think they are radicals in the sense that they believe that the Palestinian state should be established regardless of whether it threatens Israel or not. That's what makes Palestine. Give up the West Bank, give up Gaza. Even if they claim, the Palestinians, that they still want to erase you, you do it anyway. Mm-hmm. Which is, by the way, the same impulse that moves President Biden right now, who's pushing the Prime Minister of Israel and saying, you have to have a ceasefire. And the Prime Minister says, but we're not done. These people still have enough military capability to threaten our people. We have to get rid of it. And Biden says, well, I don't care. You have to stop shooting them. We'll worry about it later. Have a ceasefire. It's an impulse to stop Israel. No, I do not think that any of them would like to see Israel dismantled or dead Jews or any of them. No.
I've often wondered what Joe Biden's been in Senate for 50 years, you know, and he's just now been president for over 100 days. I don't believe the guy's running anything. I think the Obama administration, which was openly hostile to Israel, we know, I mean, outright hostile to Benjamin Netanyahu when he would visit. I remember just, you know, complete rudeness from a diplomatic point of view. They don't like Israel very much, the Obama administration, and I think they're still running this current administration. That's my read. And I always wondered, like a guy like Biden, who's very much the figurehead for sure, I thought always sort of an ally of Israel. I wonder if that's, to put it mildly, disappointing to Israelis.
Well, he was the vice president under Biden, and Biden used to go to Israel at Obama's behest and try to browbeat the Israelis then. So Biden is doing now what Biden did as vice president. But all of this is less about Israel than it is about Iran. The Biden administration, like the Obama administration, is desperate for a deal with Iran.
Why?
They think it's the linchpin of the region. It's big. It's armed. Let's be nice to it. Anyway, the Bush administration didn't like it. Trump didn't like it.
Is the thinking? I'm trying to be charitable to them. The thinking is, if we give them some money and we're nice to them and we treat them legitimately, they'll calm down and stop helping Hamas and leave Israel alone.
Yes, that was the Obama plan, okay? We bring them back into the community of civilized nations. We make sure that they understand that they are welcome in the region, and we give them money, and we trade, and we do all these things, and we sign the JCPOA, and they pretend that they're not going to build nuclear weapons. That was the Obama going in plan. It was naive at best, and it proved over the last several years that the Iranians cheat on everything. They took our money. They're still building nuclear capability. They took the money. They spent it on terrorism. They spent it on rockets. They spent it undermining, and here's where your map becomes important, the countries of the Persian Gulf and the countries of the Red Sea. The war in Yemen is Houthis against Saudi Arabia. That's all funded and stoked by Iran, which hates Saudi Arabia, hates it. So we have seen that the Iranians are not good interlocutors. And again, I will say, of the Trump administration, they looked at the Iranians and said, no, not these people. The Biden people say, wait a minute, we just weren't able to conclude the right deal under Obama. Let's go back to the principle of we pay them and they're nice. That's where we are.
Shoshana, this is a question that I think about a lot, and I've asked a few times, and I'm always interested in the answer. Alan Dershowitz on my show yesterday referred to, quote, self-hating Jews. And I've had the question asked of me so many times, how are American Jews Democrats, knowing that Democrats consistently aid, abet, ally with people who mean Israel harm? How do you answer why Jewish folks in the United States are Democrats, so loyally Democratic voters?
Well, to be fair, American Jews are much less aligned with the Democratic Party than they used to be.
Yeah.
The original impulse was that they came to America and they had come largely, the American Jewish community is Ashkenazi, it's European. They had come from places where governments were repressive from the right. And so they tended to come here and look to the left. And the left contained, in those days, in the early part of the 20th century, attractive impulses for Jews who were looking for kind of social justice and freedom of religion. And then they stuck to FDR, which was stupid because FDR was not a friend of the Jews of Europe, but never mind. And then all through the 50s and 60s, the Democrats were friends of Israel. And you had Scoop Jackson, and you had Hubert Humphrey, and you had a lot of really good Democratic support for the state of Israel. So there was an alignment between the kind of social liberalism of Jews and Friends of Israel. The alignment has crashed, and the Jews are caught between. And so you have a lot of Jews who still feel on domestic issues somewhat to the left, but on the state of Israel, better aligned with Republicans and evangelicals.
Not unlike Black Americans, quite frankly. A very similar dynamic.
Frankly, yeah. Yes, a similar dynamic. And it's a problem because it needs to be resolved in the mind of individual Jews. In, for example, the Orthodox Jewish community, which is socially more conservative, Republican registration is huge as compared to Democrat registration. In the less observant communities, which are more interested in the social dynamic of things, they tend to be more liberal and they tend to be more Democrat. But don't think that it's all one way. It's not all one way. Jews are very much split. And I don't usually do politics, but I'll just throw one at you. And that is that the Trump vote in Florida had the largest percentage of Jewish votes ever achieved by a Republican presidential candidate.
Wow.
So, you know, it's out there. It depends on how individual Jews resolve the difficulty between a party and their interests as Americans.
I know that we didn't get every question asked and answered in this conversation. I intend to continue it, but in this hour that I wanted to commit to it today, I hope this was a good 30,000-foot view. I think we probably did better than that. But I have a much clearer understanding. Do you feel, in summary, Shoshana Bryan, that we've hit the highest of high points in this discussion?
I feel, Chris, that you ask great questions, and you should stop calling them stupid questions. And yes, I think we did a big picture, and I appreciate your spending the time talking to me.
the Jewish Policy Center is where you can find the work of the senior director, Shoshana Bryan, and we will certainly have you back as a resource if you're willing. Thank you for your time, ma'am.
I'm willing. Thank you.
And that'll do it for today's show. Folks, I hope that was one that helped you maybe make sense of what we're hearing and seeing in the news today. Let me know what you thought about that conversation. I enjoyed it very much, and it gave me a lot of clarity on this conflict that is certainly ongoing and certainly not going to be easily solved. But thanks a lot for listening. Thanks for giving this a 5-star review and a written review, if you're so inclined, at Apple iTunes. Scroll to the bottom of the menu of all the shows at Apple iTunes on my list, and you'll see where you can leave 5 stars. I really appreciate that. And I will do mailbag tomorrow to close out the week, all right? So thanks a lot for being here, and we'll do Friday right here.
The Chris DeGaulle Show Podcast.